Thank you, Steve. Well, good evening, everybody, and thank you for coming out on a Tuesday night and spending roughly 90 minutes with us talking about this issue. You may be aware the United States right now is currently involved in the longest period of sustained armed conflict that's been in our nation's history. But only 1.5% of our population is involved in active military. To put that into context, during World War II, it was 9% of the population that was in the armed forces. We did a recent poll at Michigan Radio, and we asked a number of questions about veterans and the armed forces. And one of the questions we asked is, do you know someone in your family, or do you know someone well in your extended family or in your group of friends who is a veteran of either the Iraq or Afghan conflict? And very few people did. It was a real surprise to us how few people actually personally knew a veteran, or if they did, knew that that person was a veteran. But there are about 73,000 that live in Michigan. And so tonight, what we want to talk about is the transition that these veterans make when they come back from active duty overseas or return into civilian life back in Michigan. For some, that can be fairly easy. For many, it could be an extremely difficult process to make that transition. So joining me tonight to talk about this issue, down at the end is Jeff Cassidy. Jeff is an Army veteran and a Michigan Army National Guard retiree. He's currently a strategy analyst for the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency, and he served 6 overseas deployments, including tours in Iraq and in Afghanistan. So welcome, Jeff. Next to Jeff is Dr. Eric Fretz, a Navy veteran. Eric had tours in the Persian Gulf in 1992 and in Bahrain in 2005 and 6, and in Baghdad in 2008. He's active in the Student Veterans Association at the University of Michigan and the Washtenaw County Veterans Treatment Court, and has a PhD in education and psychology from the U of M. He didn't know it when he woke up this morning, but also added within the last hour to our panel is Tim Nellett. We had an earlier veteran who was going to join us, and his transportation got messed up. His mother got in an accident with the car, and everybody's okay, but couldn't get to Jackson. So when Tim arrived, we drafted him. So he is a Marine veteran. He served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he works for PAVE, which is the Peer Advisors for Veterans Education. And that's a group that connects current student veterans with incoming student veterans to help ease that transition when veterans return to school. So thank you, gentlemen, all for joining us this evening. We'll have a little bit of a discussion, and then as fairly soon I want to open it up to questions from the audience to talk about transitions. But first, Jeff, let me just start with you and ask if you could explain for us the difference between the federal VA and the Michigan VA. So to sort of clear up the confusion between the two. And then just if you could basically outline when a veteran returns or when someone becomes a veteran in Michigan, what services are available to them from the Michigan VA?
Sure, absolutely. So there's oftentimes confusion between my agency, which is the State of Michigan Agency, and the federal VA. So we're the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. And while we don't necessarily provide a tangible benefit, we don't provide disability or pension or the GI Bill, what our mission is to connect veterans to the services and benefits that they've earned through their service. And so what we found out before we were started about 2 years ago by Governor Snyder, March of 2013, and what we found out was that Michigan, even though we have the 11th highest veteran population in the country, we were 53rd out of 53 states and territories when it comes to veterans receiving benefits from the federal government. So that's a big problem. That's a huge problem. And what it means is that veterans don't realize what they're eligible for. And so that's when our agency was created, and that's our mission, is to connect veterans to the benefits and services that they've earned. And so when a veteran comes back to Michigan, we think Michigan is obviously one of the best states in the nation. And so we're trying to promote not just our agency, but what Michigan has to offer for the veteran. So just in the last 6 months, we've started our Veteran Education Initiative. And so what that is we've got 15 campuses across the state, have what we call a veteran resource representative, and this is somebody that helps the veteran on campus not only to access their GI Bill benefits and their education benefits, but somebody that can help the veteran in a more holistic manner and can refer the veteran to a veteran service officer, can talk to the veteran about getting disability compensation, can talk to the veteran about getting into the VA. So this is really somebody that the veteran can talk to and reach out to on campus that can help them in all facets of their life. We've also got our Veteran Resource Center. We've got a 1-800 number. It's 1-800-MISH-VET. So if you're a veteran, if you're a family member of a veteran, if you're a friend of a veteran, you can call our resource center, ask any questions, get referred to any resources you need, and we can help with a whole host of issues that the veteran has. So there's really a lot of things going on in Michigan right now, and it's very exciting.
Thank you. And Eric, you've done a lot of work with returning veterans in Washtenaw County and at the U of M. Are we doing enough? I mean, we've set up this agency within the last 2 years, but is that agency meeting the needs in connecting people to what the federal government can provide? And then what other needs are there that organizations like yours are helping with?
Interesting. Well, first of all, I think the NVA is doing a fantastic job because they've become a single point of reference, right? So it's like 411 for vets. So you've got a question, anything, you call that number. And that's only, you just really only have to remember one thing. And you go and you ask your question there, and they can hook you up. And that's their whole purpose. I think that's great. And then the secondary issue is there's still just a whole host of needs. So, you know, VA, we got a great VA in Ann Arbor and others. As I've said before, I think there really can't be such a thing as too much VA funding. I'd like to see them better funded with more resources, because anytime you hear about a vet having to wait for a psychiatric evaluation or wait for treatment, that just doesn't seem acceptable to me. You know, I think there's a lot of other great programs like the Washtenaw County Veteran Treatment Court, you know, that is also an important step towards getting resources towards those who are actually struggling the most. So I think we're doing a good job, and I think the question of, you know, can there be more funding and better run programs? I think absolutely, right? Like there's the degree to which all veterans, particularly in the last 10 years, the sort of the rate of deployment, the cumulative sort of moral injury sustained in the last 10 years with the pace of deployments and the nature of those deployments, I think requires an equally exceptional push from society to make sure that we take care of those veterans.
So I'm not a veteran. I haven't had any military service. I have extended family members who have. But help me understand what is that creates that difficulty for someone to transition, to sort of, you know, leave their job overseas, come back to the United States, come back into society. Where is the tension point? What creates that problem?
That's a really big question. I mean, I could cut across a whole number of angles. I think you have the first issue of, in the military, you're joining an entirely separate tribe with a different set of rules where you bond in a very unique way with a set of individuals. And so that sets a certain expectation, whether that's 2 years or 22 years. When you leave that environment, it is hugely different to come out of that environment. There's parts of that are very difficult that you're glad to leave, and there's parts of it that you miss terribly, very quickly, or over time. And that both those things cause issues. And then you have the issue of then not just that you serve in the military, but then that you deploy. So then we're talking overseas separation of any kind. So that could just be a deployment to the Horn of Africa, or it could be a deployment to a remote radar station in Alaska, or it could be a deployment to, you know, Helmand Province. I mean, it could be any of those things. And that just takes you away. It takes you away from everything. And that is a level of stress and a taking from you of things that you cannot get back. When I came back from what was not a particularly arduous, it was not a dangerous deployment to Bahrain, but it was an extended period of time where I was not with my family, and I get off that plane, and my little daughter has learned how to walk, and she will not come to me because she does not know who I am. That was quite a moment, and those are just things that kind of cumulatively, right, build up. And then adding over and above that is then if you're deploying and you are actually then in a combat zone, and then you bring in this issue of what I think is referred to a lot now as moral injury, where you as a human being are asked, not asked, told, you have no choice, but to do things that are going to put your basic humanity in conflict with sort of who you are and where you want to go. And you you will carry that forever. And so with the vets, then when I came back from Iraq, I struggled for a while. And as I mentioned in other places, once I sort of got out of my little drama, I looked around and I thought, good Lord. I mean, I was not a door kicker, right? I was a Navy guy sucked into the 18th Airborne Corps to just sort of fill a gap. And, you know, we got shot at and everything. It was a tough year. But, I mean, you had guys who were doing four or five of these deployments and were coming home to just absolute financial and emotional disasters. And they were 19 years old. And I thought, this is just crazy that what these young men and women have been asked to do and endure, and then the level of support that they find or don't find. So those are, I guess that's a long-winded answer, but all those areas are active and all those things contribute to the difficulties that veterans face.
Tim, does that match up with your experience with having deployed and then come back and returning to civilian life?
So yeah, in a lot of ways, transition is something I talk about on a daily basis and kind of work through on my own and then with the veterans I've been working through and meeting over the course of my life outside of the Marine Corps. Very much so just coming back and realizing that, like, it sounds like super cheesy or cliche or whatever, but like the world had moved on. Just the sense that here's all the stuff in the news that you never saw, or here's all the, I mean, something as simple as a song on the radio and your friend that's in your car that you just started hanging out again. You're like, what, you don't know this one? I'm like, no, I heard 3 songs on the course of my deployment because they're the only ones that get picked up on the Afghani radio, and for some reason one of them is Maroon 5. And but just realizing that things that there wasn't, it's not like the fairy tale that it kind of gets brought up as, of like World War II, buy war bonds, rationing, you know, the home front, this whole ordeal of like the whole country is in a sense like doing their part at war. Not to say that they're not doing that now, and then that the people I've encountered both during my enlistment and after have been incredibly supportive, but just the idea that the separation that occurs from going on a deployment, combat or otherwise, and then coming back and kind of trying to bridge that gap between yourself and the people who are trying to understand but are at the end of the day aren't going to, is pretty powerful and something that hits you kind of in waves. You have these moments, these little moments with people where you're like, oh, you're never going to quite understand. And I'll try, but that's just how it is.
I think another one of the transitional problems that veterans have is that once you get past the reacclimation part with your family, when I was in Afghanistan in 2012, I was responsible for the communications assets of an infantry battalion. And so my hand receipt was valued at around $2.5 million. I had 20 soldiers I was responsible for over about 25,000 square kilometers of real estate. And so I get back to the state of Michigan, and I'm literally barely qualified to be a mid-level analyst for the state of Michigan. And so that's a difficult transition when a soldier comes home or when a veteran comes home and they've got, they're responsible for millions of dollars and dozens of lives, and then they come home and they say, well, you know, you can put parts on a car, or you can do whatever. So that's a difficult transition, and it's also difficult to try and get employers to understand what our responsibilities are, and it's also kind of difficult to get the veteran to understand. You've got to temper your expectations a little bit, and maybe we can try and meet in the middle. But that's, to me, that was one of the most difficult parts of transition. Was I did all this. I can do what you need me to do. Well, maybe you can. Maybe you'll get a shot. We'll see.
It almost seems like I'm hearing sort of two different tracks of transition. I mean, there's coming back and making sure that you're getting your benefits, making sure that if you're going to go get your education, that the GI Bill stuff is known and your health care is set up. And so you've got that sort of bureaucracy transition that you have to deal with. And then on the other side, you have the social transition and sort of the community transition and dealing with that, where you did have, you know, the world stop, as you say, to come back, or people who can't relate to what your experiences are. How do those play off each other? Is there one that keeps the other from allowing a veteran to move forward? Is there one that's more important to address first when someone gets back, Or do you just get sort of caught in the situation where not being able to deal with one creates problems in the other?
For me, I think the social transition is important first. I think getting back, reintegrating with my family, being able to be around people, being able to be around crowds, not looking at everything and trying to find the best way out. Like, I think that for me, that's the first thing I had to take care of. And once I was comfortable being in public and being around other people, then I could start looking at, well, what forms do I have to fill out? How do I apply for my GI Bill? How do I get my benefits? Because if I start with all the frustrating stuff first, because applying for the GI Bill and going through the VA is very frustrating, if I do that first and I haven't dealt with my own stuff internally, nothing's going to go very well.
Are we set up to do that well, Eric, to deal with those social community issues first for returning veterans?
Well, I think the piece of this puzzle that you can't necessarily solve is that the veteran is the active piece. That's the one piece that doesn't change. And so if the veteran isn't going to seek help and it doesn't recognize the self-care issues, that's where you can sort of get into a spiral, because we have vets who came back, no involvement with the VA, were able to get back, get settled, get their minds right, do GI Bill, they come to U of M, high functioning, and these are guys that saw intense combat, multiple fatalities with their close friends. I mean, it's not that that doesn't affect them at all, but they've required basically zero input from any of the systems and are still very high functioning. And there's others that have maybe seen, I mean, in relative terms, which is hard to do, you dial it down to sort of one-tenth of the drama that this other individual saw, and they're a train wreck, right? They can't function. They're not doing well at the university. They are not socializing at all. They're holding themselves apart. They feel they are actively angry with all the idiot kids in their classes. Even though they're only 3 years older, they just literally can't stand them. Right? They talk about, I just want to choke these kids. And so there's a real problem there, and they haven't gone to the VA, and they feel like the VA isn't the place for them because they aren't sick enough, right? So it's complicated to get folks to say, hey, here are all these resources. Avail yourselves of them.
Tim, what helped you? What was sort of that first contact or first open door that helped in your transition?
So I went through something. A lot of my friends who are veterans kind of went through the same thing. We kind of had like a hiatus from all things military when we got out, and we kind of had it's almost like a fatigue from being completely like inundated with that culture all the time, and you make the decision to end your enlistment and go do something in the civilian sector. I wanted nothing to do with the military for several years. I know it's been, I have some friends who are still the same way. I have friends who made that transition faster than I did. It just kind of depends. But there were several groups available to me, be that American Legion, VFW, Disabled American Vets, all the great groups we have out there throughout the country. And then also student veteran organizations when I was in undergrad. But until junior year, when I transferred to University of Michigan, I wanted nothing to do with the military. It's like someone mentioned anything like just vets hanging out, not a big deal, don't worry about it. I was like, nah, I'm all set. And I thought that like that was just, and it was okay, but it was once I got over that, I immediately, it was like flipping a switch. It was like I wanted to get involved with someone who understood like similar life experiences, and kind of like what Eric said about you get into a couple classes with everyone who's not only significantly younger than you, but maybe doesn't even understand. You're not even speaking the same language in a lot of cases. So then I got involved with Student Veterans of America at U of M. Met a couple of really good friends there and really got like plugged in, not only with that group, but also with the director of Student Veteran Services at the school, Phil Larson. And that just really like flipped the whole switch for me. Like I was doing okay. I would say that my transition has been smoother than some of the ones I've experienced or kind of helped with. But at the same time, like I didn't really feel like that transition actually occurred until I started getting involved and working with other veterans and volunteering for peer advisors for veteran education. And that was That was when I had my like aha moment of I wanted to work with student veterans and kind of help them the way that I kind of had hoped it would help me. And by getting involved with student veterans, that's what ended up happening.
In just a minute, we're going to open up to questions from the audience. And Steve over here has a microphone, so just raise your hand and he'll come over and give you the microphone so you can ask your question. But while we're waiting for that, if for those of us who have not shared your experience, but who may know a veteran who has returned either recently or in the past, what can we do? What's the right thing to do or maybe the wrong thing to do in helping the veterans that we know?
I think for me, it's just to be there, you know. Like we're talking about, when I got home, I completely isolated myself from everything in the military. I surrounded myself with family. I surrounded myself with friends, people that I respected and I wanted to be around. And you know, let's just go to a movie. Let's go hang out. Let's go have a beer. I mean, I think being there and not pushing. Well, how are you doing? Do you have post-traumatic stress? Do you want to talk to somebody? Kind of letting the veteran come out on their own terms, and if they want to talk about something, then be there for them, and if they don't, don't push them into something that they're not comfortable with. I think that's what would help me.
Yeah, I think one of the key things is every vet is an individual, and so one of the things that will produce an immediate hostile spines up kind of response from a veteran is getting any of this. And it happens far too often, say it like U of M, oh, you know, you're an angry vet. No, I mean, I'm pissed at you because you just did something stupid, and I did serve in the military, but that doesn't make me an angry vet, right? And so watch it with the stereotyping, because, I mean, you can just see this research that's just mind-blowing, where you go and you show 100 or you show 1,000 Americans a picture of a homeless dude on the street corner, and what do you think is the most common thing they affiliate with that? It's not drug abuse, not homelessness, it's not alcoholism, it's that it's a veteran. That's just shocking to me. It's appalling, right? So there's this whole vision of dysfunctional veteran that gets hyped. And I talk about this at U of M when I work with the faculty about how even at Penn State in the Big Ten, they produced an entire video of how to deal with the angry veteran. And I'm thinking to myself, what are you doing, right? That you have all these veterans on your campus, and if somebody has a specific dysfunction, like any student can be angry, right? So it's a... those things, just treat them as an individual and work with them, right? So make no assumptions. Don't push any of this PTSD stuff. And if they want to share with you, they will. But recognize that they often don't, because no matter what the veteran has seen and experienced at whatever level, they learn very quickly, particularly the further into the combat end that they've gone, that there isn't, in the end of the day, there is a gulf that you cannot get across it. And you will end up trying to describe something, and it won't work because the shared experience isn't there. So you can have the sympathy and the support, and that's fine. But just understand that a lot of times they've sort of given up wanting to talk about that, and they're okay with that. And just to know that you appreciate what their sacrifice was is fine. A lot of times too, vets will argue even amongst themselves, well, what do I say if someone thanks me for my service? And some people are fine with it. And other people, I hate when people thank me. Don't thank me for my service. Ah. And so maybe take a middle ground and instead just say something like, I appreciate what you and your fellow servicemen and women did for us or do for us. So you're making it a team thing. Because one of the big things with veterans is it's always about the team. And anytime you single them out, you're going to trigger this distaste for being focused on as the individual. Because they will always think of the guys who did more. And so that's why they don't want to be singled out. So if you change what you're doing to say, appreciate what you and your friends did, that's, I think, an important like little pro tip if you're going to say thanks like that.
So this isn't necessarily the most popular opinion in the world, but I think it's also worth mentioning that it is a two-way street. Veterans may not realize it when they do it from time to time. I've been guilty of it myself before. But sometimes people say some things, and I think most of the time there's not malicious intent. And it's really coming from a place of not necessarily ignorance, but a lack of understanding. And the people are trying to like figure out, how do I relate to this person who may seem completely unrelatable? And in some cases, I see it fairly often these days, is that we tend to put civilians in a no-win situation of they don't know what they can and cannot say that will like set one of us off one way or another. And so they get very uncomfortable. Then we get uncomfortable. Then everybody's uncomfortable. No communication's happening, and the whole thing falls apart. So I think it comes from both ends. It's a level of just people understanding that while we're not going to have shared experiences that way, and in some ways we'll never quite understand one another from that perspective, but that, like Eric said, it's the individual. There's someone else. There's someone there you can connect with on many different levels, not just their military service, and just kind of being aware of that, and then veterans understanding that, for the most part, people aren't like out to insult you or make you feel like you aren't worth anything. They're really just trying to understand so that they can relate in any way that they can.
Do you have any questions? It's always toughest to get the first one.
Hi, I'm Rod Malloy. I helped with veteran services in California before I moved to Jackson, Michigan. Can you talk about the unique challenges that face female veterans as they return home?
Well, I'm going to step...
Here's where the lack of diversity on the panel shows itself.
I'm going to step very gingerly and respectfully onto this very thin limb, particularly and only because I have a number of awesome female veterans from across a wide range of service experiences and eras, both in the treatment court as veterans in the treatment court, justice-involved veterans. Also, I have a number of female mentors who I've trained and worked with closely who are also veterans, and I work closely. I have a couple of really, really good female veteran friends. And so I will offer only what I understand and what they've shared with me of their experience. So I would say that the one thing that's unique of the most recent generation is that they have been in what we can clearly define as combat. And we're not talking special operations raids or anything, but we're talking in combat, under fire, grievous injuries, watching their friends die, everything that we would define in classic sense of combat, it's combat. And they're coming back carrying that same amount of damage. And one of the most common things we get, particularly from my good friend Cassie, who I probably could have twisted her arm to be on this panel if I'd known she could be here, was she reports that her biggest thing is she doesn't really even talk about being a veteran because she is always marginalized. And she was a Marine and was in combat and was working, like, you know, frisking female Iraqis for, like, being suicide bombs and everything, so literally right out there with the teams. And she will always be the sort of, oh, well, you know, yeah, you served, but, you know, you didn't really do anything. Or you were a Marine, but you didn't deploy. Well, no, I deployed. Oh, well, you probably were just on the base. No, I wasn't on the base. Well, you were probably... No, I was actually out there getting shot at. And so she was constantly... kind of undercut, I guess, right? And then I think we're doing a better job from the VA standpoint of addressing the needs of that community, because let's be honest, it was relatively smaller and therefore didn't get as much attention. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else I'm really... Yeah, I think that's basically the big thing, right? Yeah.
Jeff, do you have any numbers? Do you know what percentage of the veterans in Michigan are women?
I should, but I don't. The VA, the geographic distribution of expenditures that the VA puts out has a lot of those numbers, and I don't have them memorized. But that is something that obviously we're focusing on, but it's something that we're cognizant of, because just like we're talking about, you know, in the Army, women can't be in the infantry, but they can be MPs and they can be engineers. And so they're out there, you know, they're out there in the same, doing the same stuff that the guys are doing, and it's a problem when females come back and they feel marginalized. I mean, that's, you know, I was a communication specialist, so I didn't do a lot of door kicking, but people come up to me and shake my hand and thank me for my service when there are female MPs that did a heck of a lot more than I did when it comes to straight combat, and it's a problem when they feel marginalized.
Any other questions? Yes, the gentleman back there.
Todd, I have more of a comment. You were discussing earlier how
There are many things you miss about the military, and one of them I'd like to add would be is the structure that it gave. Coming into the civilian life is, while in the military you have so much structure, you know, you're going to come in at 6:30, formation, PT, go home, shower, come back at 9, work, so on and so forth. And you know what your job was day in, day out. When after you get out, you've moved, day one, your new life starts, it's like, well, what am I going to do? I don't feel like shaving. Who cares? I'm not going to run today. So what? What am I going to do? What job am I going to go out for? And that's a big thing is I really hated it when I was in the service, but it's something that I actually crave for now, and it's so odd.
Is that something that can stall a veteran? Like you get back and no one's telling you exactly what to do, so you know, as you said, you don't do anything, and then you're not going to expos or job fairs or pursuing a degree or anything like that. You just kind of are stuck.
So there's something to be said for the beauty and the terror of a blank page. we see this all the time, not just with student veterans, but just veterans transitioning out of the military in general, that, like you said, there's so much structure, and it does get a little overbearing while you're in, and you've got, you know, your sergeant, your gunnery sergeant, and so on and so forth, bearing down on you, but at the same time, you get used to it, you adjust, you make that your routine, and it becomes part of your life, and then you get out, and it's almost completely inverted. You have limitless possibility, but in some cases, no direction whatsoever, which can be pretty daunting in a lot of ways. We found that from personal experience, we have people that may try to make that transition, and not necessarily just because they're doing it alone, but I think it does contribute in that way. They try to transfer over, and thus just the possibilities and the options and the lack of complete oversight whatsoever leads them to maybe not necessarily make bad choices, but to kind of stall, like you said, is where, oh, I don't know what I want to do. I don't even know how I to do it if I knew what I wanted to do. And so,
like analysis paralysis.
Yeah, and I don't want to like word it the wrong way, because I definitely proud of my service, but we see what we call it recidivism, because they come out, they are presented with a whole world available to them, and then say, well, I need my structure, get me back to my structure, and then they go right back in. So it's something we found all over the place, and it's been your mileage may vary. It goes from veteran to veteran, but we found that the way we do it in my program, and then just I personally, is finding someone who's already done that transition, getting them connected and saying, like, you know, it's not as daunting as it seems. You did this job. Some of the jobs in the military, every one of them is challenging in its own way, and if anyone can do any one of those positions, all you gotta do is apply that same effort and focus and drive into something in the civilian sector, and you're gonna make it.
Shifting back and forth across these tribes and communities is fascinating. I mean, I did this a number of times, from reserve to active, from civilian to academia, academia to reserve, academia to active, and then back to academia. And every time, it was something new and unexpected and unusual. And eventually, it got to the point where I was just kind of amused by it, and I kind of would just keep notes. But just the idea of going from one community to another, so that when I'm in academia and I'm trying to get my PhD, and you learn to have all these long-winded answers for things, like tonight, and then I'm standing in front of a lieutenant colonel with a major, army major, who's sort of my running mate, and I'm giving this long, long answer. I'm probably in about my second minute. She finally snaps, and she just punches me, and she's like, get to the point! You know, because the Army has this rule, BLUF, bottom line up front, get it done, give them what the answer is, and get out of there. And so these different communities and all the different ways, everything, that's just a small example of the culture, and that just comes up over and over and over again. We see vets who, there was one a couple years ago, he was about to have a mental breakdown prior to graduation, because he had just spent the whole day, like every other senior at Michigan, going from office to office and form to form, finding out where to get his gown, how to get this, how to file, how to do this checklist, turn this in. And he was just beside himself because of the comparison of how inefficient and frustrating, and he had to ask answers, and it was dozens of students doing the same thing, because his vision is, how would we do this back in my battalion? We would line up every single person who's graduating. The E8 would come in. Oh, are you guys getting lined? The E7 would be like, you go over there. And then there would be an E6 doing this and an E5 handing the things out, and everybody would march through. And anybody who didn't do it right got dragged off to the side and, you know, got smoked. And then they brought them back. And then 2 hours later, everybody's done. And right? And he was losing his mind because in the university, that's all gone. There's no E8, E9 who is watching over you. There's no E7 to turn to. There's like no O2 over there who's making a mess but eventually can fix something for you. You know, there's just, right? So, you know, it's a huge change in the culture.
So the idleness, though, that the gentleman spoke of, and sort of the lack of structure upon returning, is that one of the things that can contribute to the self-destructive behavior or the addiction problems that some veterans can face?
I think so, and when I talk to veterans, I try and get them, or I try and express to them that it's important that you can create your own structure. So, especially when you're just transitioning and you don't even know what you want to do. I just left active duty. I don't want to have anything to do with the military, but I crave that structure. Create your own structure. You know, in the morning, get up and go for a run. If you don't want to run or you can't run, go for a walk. But do something physical to get yourself waking up. And then from 9 to 11, jump on the internet and try and find a job or look for schools or compare schools, compare employment opportunities, or just mindlessly surf until you're able to find something that interests you. And then, you know, from 11 to 1, have some lunch and play some Xbox. And just create a structure for yourself that you do on a daily basis.
So Jeff, you kind of agreed with me, but Eric, you sighed like, boy, Vince, do you have that wrong.
No, I was thinking it's interesting. It's a complicated question. I mean, I think there's lots of folks that have that time. I don't think the shift in cultures is, or the time is necessarily a problem, unless the vet chooses to fill it with recreational alcoholism, right? Which is something we do train in the military. But you know, it's so you want to try to avoid that. And then I think the other problems come where if you have underlying issues, right? If someone is really the biggest problem is self-medicating, right? I have PTSD, I have depression, I'm struggling, I don't like how I feel. And as some of my vets have told me, like, oh, in the treatment court, they'll say, oh, it never dawned on me to go to the VA for my issue because I wasn't sick. I didn't have a broken leg, I didn't have a back problem, I don't have a disability rating. They're like, but you're drinking a fifth every morning, so maybe you should go to the VA. So, right, and that sort of thing, where they don't turn that corner necessarily, and they're self-medicating to deal with these underlying issues. And we see this in the treatment court all the time, where you'll get a person in, he or she will just be a train wreck of substance abuse and poor decisions, and 9 months later, with the efforts of the VJO and the VA, and local treatment authorities and mentors and the whole treatment court process, they'll have everything squared away. They'll start a business. They'll be heading back to school. Everything will be fine. But it's because we're able to marshal all those resources and focus it down, shore up all those shaky spots, get the foundation all leveled out and strong, right? And then they can just build whatever they want. But until you get that broken part fixed, anything you try and do is just going to fall over.
Another question?
Question here.
Thank you. Hi, thanks so much. My name is Lori Carr. I run the Southeast Michigan chapter of Pets for Vets. We train shelter animals for veterans who could really benefit from having a companion animal. One of the things, I've got like a ton of questions, I'll try and keep it brief. One of the things I've noticed in some of the veterans in our program is those older vets from Vietnam, so forth, have quite a network they can rely on, fall back on. I've gone to a number of Legion events, and there's a very different community feel there. And it doesn't seem that there is an equivalent for this generation of veterans. And I'm wondering how that can be created, who's to do it, and why do you think that hasn't really taken root? The other thing I wanted to put out there was, So many people think of veterans as either they've got PTSD or they're right back on track. And it's having that kind of long, sustained exposure to that sort of stress can result in actual neurobiological effects, whether or not that's diagnosed as frank PTSD or not. The evidence-based therapies like cognitive behavioral and so forth that have really shown some really beneficial effects, there seems to be a lack of resources in that regard, particularly in Michigan. I don't think we have nearly enough cognitive behavioral therapists anyway, but do you see telemedicine as being a potential route to trying to get those kinds of evidence-based methods to more veterans who are, you know, in rural communities, in deepest Detroit, all over, where they may not necessarily want to reach out, have no clue how to find those resources at the VA, or have no confidence that it may be of help?
So I promise we'll get to both. Let's start with the first one. Why this perception or reality that there is a lack of community among the post 9/11 vets compared to veterans before that?
I wouldn't say there's a lack of community. I would say it's not as visible in the sort of classic sense, and that's for two really big reasons. One, the population of vets we're talking about is incredibly small in terms of raw numbers overall, right? They're spread out. They're very isolated in general, right? Whereas World War II, I mean, there was a reason why there's multiple VFW posts and American Legion posts in every American town in the 1950s. Because there's too many people to fit in one, right? You know, even in Arbor and in Ypsilanti, you see slowly they sort of consolidate, but they're still all over the place. And the numbers just aren't there, so that's one thing. The other thing is, and then they end up being separated, so there's very hard to get critical mass. The other thing is they're very digital, right? And so this is a relatively different way of looking for association. And so there is the IAVA, the Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans Association. They are essentially the digital Facebooky equivalent of the VFW and the American Legion. And if you are an Iraq-Afghanistan vet and you're not a member, you should be, because you just sign up online. It doesn't cost anything. They're very, very digitally hip and engaged. They do a lot of great stuff legislatively. They're paired up with the SVA and a bunch of other places. So all the guys who are using the GI Bill, for example, can have access nationwide now to the Student Veterans Association, which is something that started at the University of Michigan in 2008. Just to, you know, toot our horn. And there you go. So I think the IAVA is out there, and they're working hard, and they've connected a lot. And SVA is out there, and they're working hard, and they provide a lot of great support. And then to their credit, you know, American Legion and VFW, I mean, I'm a life member of both, and I participate when I can in those events. You know, they're trying hard, but we have to be realistic, right? I mean, let's be honest. Even in my role as a mentor for the SVA on campus, the new guys come in, they're like, who's that overweight old guy? I buy him a couple pitchers and then we're friends and it's fine. But, you know, it's a challenge. And so they're not, right, they're not interested in going to the, going to the VFW and sitting around and having a couple beers and talking about stuff, at least in general. Once they make friends there, they do. So I have some friends who are Iraq Afghanistan era who are members of the VFW American Legion and are very happy with their affiliation. And so there's work to be done there to try and bridge that. And all I can say is most of it's going to have to come from the Legion and the VFW side, as annoying as that may be, right? Because you're going to have to literally track these guys down and drag them in, kind of like we do with the SVA. Our biggest effort with the SVA is to get those student vets to come to the first meeting so they see, oh, this is great. Like, right, all of the cool stuff of the military and none of the bull crap. Yeah, I'm in, right? But if they don't get to that first meeting, and we can bomb them with email messages all year long, and they'll be like Tim talked about. Oh, military, heck no, bunch of vets sitting around doing military. Nope, not for me. No way. I'm going to keep that all in the box. So over time, it could change, but it's not as bleak as I think maybe you think. The IAVA's out there, SVA's out there, and they're doing a good job.
Her second question is about telemedicine, it's also called telehealth. We did a story as part of our series about the Veterans Hospital or Medical Center in the UP that's using a lot of this, because there are sometimes people will drive, it's a 2 or 3 day round trip just to have a cardiac check. And so if you can get on one of these telehealth machines, they can look at an injury, they can take your heart rate, they can check your lung capacity all on this machine. Should we be doing more of that? Is there a need for more of that across our state?
I think that telehealth is the next step in healthcare. And the VA in Michigan is really embracing that. The Battle Creek VA, they've got a 22-county catchment area, and they literally have dozens of community partners where they provide the telehealth equipment for free to these community partners. Veterans can come in, use the equipment to interact with the VA, and you know they don't have to travel from Muskegon all the way to Battle Creek. Same thing in Ann Arbor. Saginaw has, I was working with Saginaw about 6 months ago. They have over 30 veterans who get their therapy on their iPad. They don't even come into the VA. They get it straight on their iPad. They talk to their therapist, and then they go about their day. So and the UP as well. So the VA is really, really embracing telehealth. And like I said, with the Battle Creek Initiative, they're working with community mental health facilities in the communities to where veterans can come into the CMH and they can interact right with the VA right from the CMH. And like I said, they provided that equipment for free as part of a community partnership. So it's telehealth is moving at light speed, and the VA is embracing it, and they're moving as fast as they can with it. It's very important. It's good stuff.
I think the first part of your question about telehealth as well broached a very important thing I want to highlight, which is you're kind of talking about subclinical issues that the vets are carrying, and you're right on it, because there are those who clearly have so much, they have problems with life adjustment. They clearly are not okay. Those actually are the easier ones to get help with. Whereas we should all be aware that the vets of all kinds can carry all kinds of burdens, and it's not necessarily combat. There could be, you know, the person who was on a radar site in Alaska who saw his friend crushed by heavy machinery when they were installing a radar dish or something, and that can be PTSD, and that's totally legit and very, very sad, right? Or just even in the vets that I work with in the treatment court or in the SVA, it happens. One of them was over for a 4th of July celebration I was having just a couple days ago, and I was about to do some fireworks. He said, you know, how much fireworks are you doing? I said, a lot. He said, can I go inside? I'm like, of course you can go inside. And I was like, you know, don't worry about it, brother. And I get it, right? There's been times we've been out socializing in a club, perhaps, and it's getting really crowded and we're getting hemmed in, and you can see it in his eyes. And we're like, okay, let's go outside, brother. Let's go outside and take a walk. Because it's everything that they can do not to just start screaming and running around. And so you just need to, back to that thing about every vet is an individual. You know, you just need to watch and have a little empathy and understand that at any time, kind of like in real life, people right next to you, vets or not, they could be struggling in ways you have no idea. So I think that's just an important thing that you brought up. I appreciate that.
Does the telehealth help with the wait times that we've heard about with the VA? And how do Michigan's wait times compare with the rest of the country?
So you still have to have an appointment with a provider. So it doesn't necessarily help with wait times per se. I think that those are the change or the help would be nominal, but Michigan's wait times last year when Shinseki left and he was replaced, they did a study on all the VAs, and Michigan actually was in the top 5%. So we've got two different networks. The Lower Peninsula is in Network 11, and the UP is in Network 12. But both 11 and 12 had really good wait times. There was only one hospital that was over 30 days, and I think that was Detroit. But nationally, in Michigan, the wait times are pretty good. And that's actually been mitigated even more by the CHOICE Act. So if you have to wait more than 30 days, you can actually receive local community help. And the VA will cover that. So the CHOICE Act has helped mitigate that even more.
Other questions?
I'm a World War II veteran, and I'm relatively busy with the veterans organizations here in Jackson. I am familiar, I've been listening, and I'm familiar with the reception these fellows have gotten. It makes me ashamed of the reception I got when I came back after World War II. The brass bands, the jobs, free pie in any restaurant, any theater walk into. We got a good reception. I'm also the commander of the Purple Hearts here, and we're trying to recruit. We know there are a lot of Purple Hearts among these veterans. There's a number of them. And they aren't coming out with it. We would like to recruit them. Also, I meet with the Vietnam veterans on Tuesday morning at a restaurant. There's about 29 to 30 of them. And I'm familiar with the post-traumatic situation. If you know any of them, encourage them. If they're not getting involved, encourage them. If you have any in the family who are veterans of any war, encourage them to come to the different posts. I've been commander out at the 29 twice, and we're looking for these veterans that are coming back now. There'll be the door is wide open. They will be received. I know what they're going through, and that when I compare it with what it was when I came back, I say I'm almost ashamed of myself. But if you know any of them, encourage them. Jackson County has one of the best Veterans Affairs offices in the state. I know that for a fact because I have visited some of the others. All you got to do is get them to walk in the office. It's up on the second floor at the county building out on Lansing Avenue. The door is wide open. The help is there. Information is there. Encourage them to come up. Thanks.
Is there a sense, do post-9/11 veterans have the feeling sort of that this gentleman have about the reception coming home? I mean, it's if you read the books like, you know, The War Goes to Plum Street and things like that, you have a sense that during World War II, the whole nation was at war. During Vietnam, that reception was completely different from what the World War II veterans got, or even the veterans today. But now it seems like the nation's not at war, just the military is at war. And so what does that create for the veterans when they come home? And you know, like the gentleman said, they're not getting brass bands. There certainly are people who will say, as you said, you know, thank you for your service in the airport, but there isn't this sort of community embrace when they return.
I don't know that I would say that. Anytime that I was in uniform, anytime that I was coming home from deployment, if I was in an airport or if I was on drill and I would go to Panera Bread, anytime I was in uniform, somebody paid for my lunch. Every time. Every time I had a meal paid for me, and I never knew who it was. I always had people coming up thanking me for my service. So for me and for most of the people that I served with, the homecoming has been spectacular. And I would say that I feel like this gentleman, when it comes to Vietnam veterans, I'm actually almost embarrassed that you know, they got the reception that they got, but I have people buying my lunch every time I put a uniform on.
So I had working with several Vietnam-era veterans with different military programs. And one of the first things we always end up talking about was different levels of reception coming home, especially between the different eras. And one of the things I'd always hear was, we just don't want you guys to be treated the way we were treated. And I've got to say, that effort has shown through without a doubt. I don't think at any point I felt the way that these men and women felt coming home from that war. And I think that in part of that was that the effort made by not only the regular populace, but the Vietnam era veterans that were saying, not again. And really just incredibly warm reception, just saying, like, you know, whatever we can do to help, we'll do it. Just, you know, point the way, that sort of thing. So just my personal experience, at least, has been incredibly supportive.
I would agree, yeah.
Steve, I'll take the question back there, but then after that, I'm going to take moderator's prerogative, and this gentleman here has been raising his hand every time that we've had a question. So back there, and then this gentleman next.
First of all, thank you guys for visiting Jackson all the way, long distance from Ann Arbor. But and also, thank you for Michigan Radio, who does really great reporting, I feel, on veterans' issues compared to many of the NPR stations I've listened to around the country moving around. My question is sort of relates to what happens after the military in a way, because it's about preventative issues. Growing up here in Jackson, I grew up in schools where military recruitment was happening in middle school through high school. And I feel like I'm kind of opposed to that, but I'm not like going to go do something crazy about it. But I do feel like maybe the understanding of stuff that happens afterwards to our veterans, which I think can be really sad, can also be really great, stuff like education and kind of a way out of poverty or lower middle class. How do we kind of make things more realistic for our 17 and 18-year-old kids to prevent, you know, what's happening now? You know, how can we, or prepare them for, hey, you know, you may come back totally changed in ways that are or are not positive. And I think there's a pretty big issue there. Thanks.
I would agree that's a big issue, but if I'll take a risk of sounding like a jerk here, but I think in a big picture perspective, what you're talking about isn't going to happen. It almost can't happen, because when you're running an all-volunteer military that's struggling to make quota just in general, with only a tiny fraction of the available youth even qualified to go in, then they're going to end up trying to take anyone they can. And so going in and having them sign some kind of really depressing waiver or watch some videos of dudes with their legs blown off, that's not going to happen, right? That's like somebody who's about to buy a car and you show them like the really bad, like you're going to buy a sports car, but you show them the decapitation accident when the sports car goes under the back of the 18-wheeler. Oh, want to buy a sports car? So I don't think that that is really going to be possible from a military perspective. Now, as a society, I suppose there's nothing stopping us from passing a law that says, prior to signing on the line of all volunteer force, you have to watch this video. And I mean, that's theoretically possible in terms of how we run our democracy, but I think it's unlikely. I think the real answer is we just have to get more realistic with why and how we go to war, because the way that we do it in this country now, I'm just going to be honest, it sucks, right? So you have an all volunteer force where you have essentially this elite cadre that serves. It tends to be multi-generational within families, but not exclusively. They tend to serve for long periods of time. There's been no draft since the 70s. So you're multiple generations away from anybody experiencing the draft and having everyone be exposed to risk when the nation sends the military at war. So when it can just be deployed as if it's a plaything, this is what you're going to get. So all politics aside, it's just too easy to take the military and throw it at whatever you want to throw it at. And that is, if you want to address it, because war has always sucked. There's always, they've called it a different name, battle fatigue or shell shock or whatever they called it in the Greeks and Persians war. But every recorded instance of a war ever fought has talked about PTSD and what happens to veterans. It's not new. Everybody knows it. And there are no old men who want to go to war, right? Well, except for a few politicians. So right, that's your problem, right, is to set something in place where we don't use the military the way we do, and we won't have these issues. Because we got involved in one war, then two, and then we had the surge. You know, and in 2006, 2007, and 2008, they dropped all of the filters. The military was taking anyone, people with prior felony convictions, major mental health issues. We will be paying for that for 50 years, because these individuals who were already broken went into the military, got more damaged, and now are back, and they need to be taken care of. And the VA is going to be carrying that load for decades. And we as a society and as a government, we did that, right? We made the machine that recruited them, trained them, and sent them over there. We supported didn't kick out the politicians who put us in that position. So I think that's your answer. It's not so much briefing young men, because they don't listen. You can talk to some of my vet friends who talk about, he just did a great video, it's also by NPR, and he talked about how he wanted to be a Marine infantryman when he was 13 years old. He was going in no matter what. And he's a very different man now. But even if he could go back and talk to himself, I don't think he could talk himself out of it. So
I'll try and keep this brief. Story time, since Eric decided to mention about talking about not being able to talk young men out of going to war. And I really hope that this isn't live, so I guess he'll never hear it. Young Tim was 17 and wanted to go into the Marine Corps and couldn't go in without a signature from his father, who decided when he picked a combat position that he was not going to sign his waiver. So Like the crazy stories you hear about from kids in World War II that went in when they were like 15 and lied about their age. I told my dad I was going to join artillery electronics because it had a sign-on bonus, and that seemed like a logical thing to do. And he signed it, and about 5 minutes later, I told my recruiter, switch it to infantry. And two deployments later, here I am. I can't say from a preventative standpoint, in all seriousness, probably the easiest thing, and it's terrible, is in a lot of ways, and it's not obviously not for everybody, but in my personal opinion, an easy way to prevent the lead up to a war that may or may not occur as a nation is to go to war. I didn't quite get it until I went with my battalion. But then you find out that the guys you've been serving with, the guys you trained with for months on end, sometimes years, you get there, and the mission is important. The mission is something that everyone needs to take care of, and we're there for the fight. But at the end of the day, you get there, and you look to your buddy on your left, your buddy on your right, the people that you're probably going to be closer to your entire life than you're ever going to be than anyone else, is you want them to come back alive. And it just comes down to pure survival. And I can tell you, survivor's guilt is a very real thing, a very terrible thing, and something I would never wish on anyone. But just to get on with questions that are probably more conducive to what I'm going on right now. War is hell. And I don't know if there's ever going to be a way to properly convey that, but I think the every generation who's ever went really understands that and can really speak to that, I believe.
Sir.
I did a tour in Afghanistan and three in Iraq.
Bring the mic a little bit closer.
Some of the things that I went through when I came back home was trying to transition back into the civilian world also. Part of that dealt with the VA. If I wanted to schedule an appointment with any mental health, I was 6 months out. Still to this day, I'm 6 months out. You talk about the CARE Act. I can call the CARE Act number, and that's going to depend on whether or not the VA will let me go to that doctor. You spoke on survivor's guilt. You know, I deal with that sometimes also. Which is one of the reasons why I don't wear a Purple Heart, is because I was one of the survivors or one of the ones that suffered minor injuries. So my question is, what is Michigan doing as far as how we can advance care for veterans? Because the VA, I think, is falling far short of the care that they could provide. There's many changes that are going on as far as therapy for veterans or as far as PTSD is concerned, but the VA doesn't want to change their ways. When I came home, I went to the VA for compensation or whatever protocol they want you to go through. I sat in front of a computer and I answered 375 questions. Some of those questions were, do I think people are getting over on me? Do I try to get over on people? Do I think about committing suicide? How much do I drink? If I said, yeah, I drink a lot, well, one, I'm a Marine, so yeah, I drink a lot. Do I have a problem? No. Have you ever thought about committing suicide? Yes, I've thought about it. Have you ever done it? No. But if I answer those two questions, I now have to go to AA. And I now have to go to check into some mental health where they're going to evaluate me on whether or not I'm able to sustain on my own. I think also veterans of my era also play, and I'm speaking only from my own personal experience, as many of the veterans that I deal with or fellow veterans, we play the victim role. And we play it very well. Thankfully, I didn't stick in that role for very long. But when I did get out, I tried to get a job. It was hard to find a job. My skills are shooting a gun from long range. I could be a police officer, but I just spent all that time overseas. I don't want to come back here and do the same thing. what skills do I have now? Well, now I can spend time and go to college, which I did. Even after college, now I don't have the experience. So we have that to deal with also. I wrote some notes down here. World War II veterans, when they came back, we can all agree that that's probably the greatest generation ever. When they were off fighting in a war, everyone else picked up and they helped the economy get going again. They went to work. When those veterans came back, they also went to work. When they came back, they started new businesses and things like that. I find it harder to now, once we're back, it's harder to try to start our own businesses. There are a lot of roadblocks that way. When we think about it, less than 1% of veterans, or less than 1% of the national population can call themselves a veteran. Let's take the population of Michigan and then compare that to a percentage. Yet we can't find the funding to improve the VA, improve other programs for veterans, to get them jobs. You know, those are some of the things that I look at, and I want some answers on as well.
I just want to ask you just a quick question. When you take that questionnaire on the computer, have other people talked to you beforehand? So do you know going in, these are the questions that are going to trigger something and this is how I need to answer them before you take that test?
Well, what I learned was if I answer certain questions a certain way, this is going to happen. So they're basing my PTSD off of those questions, never sitting in front of an actual therapist, saying, hey, here's the deployments I went on, here's what I experienced over there, never once. So now you get this, okay, you're rated at a 54, your GAF score is a 54. Well, that puts you at a mid-range, so your PTSD is only a percentage of 30%. That's my rating through the VA. Now, if I go back after a set amount of years and I say, okay, well, when I answered yes, I thought about suicide or I drink a lot. Now, this time, I'm not going to answer that way. I'm going to answer a different. I'm going to answer no, I don't drink a lot. No, I don't think about suicide. Now, my score goes down. Now, I have a 10% PTSD, still never sitting in front of a therapist. When I do finally get to sit in front of a therapist, it's 6 months down the road or more. Then when you get used to being in front of that therapist, they move on or they're no longer with the VA. Now I'm with a different one and I'm starting all over again. What's your age? How many family members do you have? Where do you rank in that family? So I never get to the point of saying, hey, here's my experience. How do we move on from here?
Jeff, you go to the website and it looks like there's all sorts of services for veterans. Help getting a job, help with school, medical care. So where's the disconnect? Why do we hear so frequently these types of stories where someone has such difficulty getting in front of a therapist or has such a long wait time? And I don't want to put you on the spot and make you defend the whole country system, but give us some insight into how these types of problems happen.
Well, I can't, like I said before, I work for the state agency. I don't work for the federal VA, so I can't really speak for the federal VA. But those wait times are based on those ratings. And so if somebody is rated higher, then they're going to get in more often. They're going to get earlier. If somebody's rated lower, then they're not going to get in as often, or they're not going to get in as quickly as they would like. And that's obviously not something that we're happy with. Like I said, I can't speak for the VA. What we're doing in Michigan, and that's why we were created, was to not only connect veterans to benefits, but try and create awareness and try and dig down into the communities as well. So we've created veteran community action teams across the state. Governor Snyder broke the state down into 10 regional zones. Across the state of Michigan is into 10 regional zones, and so we've created 6 veteran community action teams. And these community action teams are designed for community service providers to get together, talk about the services that they provide veterans, and then do a warm handoff. So let's say I'm a provider that has substance abuse programs for veterans, but I don't have any housing. I can't house them. Well, there's another organization that does housing for veterans, but they don't do substance abuse. So I can do a warm handoff with the veteran that I'm seeing for substance abuse and put them into a housing situation. And so we've got six of these community action teams across the state. We've got another four rolling out next year. We started in Kent County and the Metro Detroit area, and they've been very successful. In Metro Detroit, we've got over 150 service providers in that VCAT. And so that's our role, is to dig down into the community, find out what resources are available, and get the veteran to those resources. So I'm sorry you're having such a difficult time, and if there's anything I can do, I've got cards over here. I'd love to talk to you offline. My business cards are over here, as well as cards for our agency are over on the table. And we can work with the VA. We could talk to the VA, and I can certainly ask about specific situations. But at the end of the day, we don't necessarily have authority over the VA. And so that's a difficulty that we're struggling with, is trying to work with the VA and trying to get specific veterans the help that they need.
Thanks.
Big bureaucratic systems are just not always going to deliver high-quality results. As hard as anyone tries, that's just the nature of something that large. And I feel really bad that you're experiencing sort of something that's kind of inevitable, right? I mean, inevitably, no matter how you set it up, there's going to be some vets having suboptimal situations. Clearly, what you're describing is one of them. And I think the number one thing from a practical standpoint is, if there is something near you that could be the answer, it's going to be these guys, because that's their job, is, hey, this is a crappy situation where the system isn't working right. How do we unjam this? Because he has a Rolodex. And in that Rolodex, I'm sure, is the guy for the Ann Arbor VA, right? Or the I think it's James McDivitt or whatever his name was. So you can, you know, if you're having a really bad situation, you know, it is an adaptive behavior to keep assertively seeking assistance, right? You don't want to necessarily be a foot stomper. I get your point about playing the victim thing. You know, we have a lot of discussions amongst the vets in Michigan about the entitled veteran problem, because every once in a while you'll find those guys who are, you know, going around complaining because they didn't get a veteran's discount for their bagel or something, and we're just like, oh, come on, man. Just use your GI Bill. It's only $100,000, right? Relax. So, and the other thing your story points out is the importance of using veteran service offices. So you get American Legion, VFW, both do this, plus I know Washtenaw County has an awesome vet service office. There are folks who are trained to handle these comp and pen disability claims. And they, if you go to them first and order your service record, your medical record, and sort out all this stuff before you insert yourself into the VA. Because if you go to the VA and ask the VA about your comp and pen, you are entering the system in the wrong way. You are going to the banker to ask, that's the wrong analogy. You're going to the VA as a health system is still part of the VA. And the doctors at the VA, although they don't, it's not a hostile process, the job of the doctors who see you at the VA is to blow your claim out of the water, to minimize it, to legitimize it, but if possible, to eliminate it. Right? I mean, I'm not saying they're compensated that way, but I'm saying their job is to be the barrier so that you can't just come in and say, I want 100% disability because I'm upset all the time. Oh, here you go. Right? So their job is to be in between you and your rating, whereas the service officer is the one who is actually there walking side by side with you and knows the system, knows what buttons to click or not click to, so that you're fully informed. I mean, you're still, you know, should do the right thing and answer the questions truthfully, but getting those service officers involved for your comp and pen is the best decision you can do, because if you go about it on your own, you will get run over.
Another question?
Thank you. Good evening, and thank you very much for joining us tonight, men. I have a question. Do you feel there's enough support for suicide prevention? I know that's a tough one. And if not, what would you like to see in place to help our veterans with suicide?
So suicide is kind of a double-edged sword. So we have several programs in place, but at the same time, if we can't get a veteran to walk through the door and let us know that there's a problem, or talk to a friend or talk to a family member or talk to anybody, then that's a problem. If we can't reach out to them and let them know what resources are available, That's the problem. And so I'm certainly not trying to say veterans are the problem, but us trying to figure out how to break through that wall and how to get through kind of that fog is really the bigger issue. I don't think it's necessarily about services or resources that are available. Do I think there are enough? I don't think there's ever enough. Do I think that there are a lot? Do I think that we're doing the best that we can? I really do. But at the same time, we have to figure out a better way to get through to the veteran and let the veteran know that there is help, there is a way to treat post-traumatic stress, and there are people that care. And you know, you matter to me. That's how do we break through that? I don't know.
Do you think the concept of having a band of brothers? Thank you. A band of brothers amongst the veterans, where the veterans have their own group for suicide prevention? Because I feel if you have a band of brothers, it would be more inviting.
I do, and I think that program exists. It's called Buddy to Buddy. That's a great program, but once again, and there are a lot of people that Buddy to Buddy has helped, and there are a lot of veterans that are active with Buddy to Buddy, but at the same time, I have to want to talk to you.
Right.
I have to want to talk about my problems. I have to want to dig deep and let you know that I'm, you know, I'm weak and I can't handle it. And a lot of veterans don't want to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
I think it's a two-pronged thing because you have, if you think of this as like a waterfront with a bunch of swimmers, I mean, there's people who are drowning who raise their hand. So you want to have enough life rings to throw. And so on the one hand, if someone's raising their hand, hey, I'm drowning, we need to throw the life ring. So we can't have the six-month wait. We can't have the parent and the vet calling, I'm losing it, I need a psych eval. They need to be in the psych ER that night, and they need to be seeing somebody the next day. It can't be see you in 3 weeks, because those are the ones when those suicides go, that is just a blot on our national character. That's completely unacceptable. But then there's the other folks who are in the water and are struggling, but they're not raising their hand. And at some level, that is an intractable problem, because you can't throw a life ring to everyone, and you can't throw a life ring if the hand isn't up. And so figuring out who that is, the only way you get there is, in my belief, and this is one of the things I've been trying to foster, is immediate support sort of networks, veteran to veteran. So that's why I love PAVE, I love Buddy to Buddy. The Veterans Court is awesome, SVA, because you create that environment where you have trusted people who you can lean on and you can say, I'm struggling. And so that, I think, makes a huge difference to get you back in that community so that you're not alone. Because the individuals, we've lost a couple vets at Michigan. Not in a couple years, we lost one in the Veteran Treatment Court. And in every case, they felt, and in some cases very, which were, alone. They had isolated, they had self-isolated. People tried to reach out. And you don't want to harass somebody, and you don't want to mess with them, and you don't want to be a pain in their butt. But it's such a hard, right? But if they're part of a community, it's much easier to provide that support.
I think we have time for two more questions.
Hi, my name's Dave Van Hoof. I'm a veteran mentor with the Jackson County Treatment Court. The question I have for you is the state of Michigan. Does the state of Michigan have a database where they know who and of their citizens are currently in the military? Because I'd like to bring up my personal experience. I'm a retired officer, Marine Corps, done a number of tours, six, all of them combat. I've been away a lot, and I had my home here, and I'm single. My last tour, got injured, lost a number of my Marines. You know, I'm going through that process where I want to go through my social processing and go through this, you know, because I was a decision maker. I send them out on missions, did my op plans to minimize harm and damage, and, you know, it doesn't work perfectly. So I have to, you know, come through and work through this. Get injured, I come home, no time to process anything. It's straight to the VA, straight to treatment, straight to, you know, recovery. And that's your focus. But I still got the baggage. Come home to Michigan. Get a letter from, you know, the Attorney General. Welcome home. Appreciate you. Thank you for your service. 2 days later, I get a notice from the Department of Treasury, State of Michigan. While you're away, we revoked your primary resident exemption. You owe us $10,000 because you haven't been living in your home. These two issues, my injury and the state of Michigan, I've been dealing with for the last 3 years. So I still haven't had this process, you know, to work through things, but I've been doing it concurrently. But I'm still dealing with the state of Michigan giving me my money back. And it's just the state of Michigan didn't know I was in the military. I filed my tax return and let them know I get, you know, exempt status for being government, but the township knew who I was, where I was. County knew who I was, where I was. State of Michigan had no idea. He's not in his home. He's not living there. It's not his primary residence. Let's get the $10,000. I'm dealing with the entire bureaucracy, trying to explain to them. And like you said, majority of them have no connection to the military, have no understanding. I go all the way to the governor's office, Governor Snyder. His staffer tells me, well, looks like you need to go get a lawyer. Get a lawyer. And I'm saying, well, I'm bringing this to your attention so this can be fixed. So I come to you. Is there such a system where the state is monitoring who of its citizens are currently in the military?
So I'd be happy to talk to you afterwards. I'll give you my card. We can communicate about what's going on with the state. The short answer to the question is no, absolutely not. The VA doesn't even have those numbers. So the VA can't tell us what veterans are, and the DOD won't share that information with us either. So the DOD and the VA don't really talk, and they don't share their the VA shares public information, but getting information that they have that they don't publish is literally an act of Congress. So the state of Michigan, the NVAA, just got, we had to do this statutorily, we changed the law, but now when veterans come home to Michigan and we know they're coming home, we send them a letter, not the Department of Technology Management and Budget, which is what it used to be. And so we're able to send them a letter, provide them with resources within their community, let them know that we're available to help in any way that we can. And your homestead exemption is something that, like I said, I'd really like to talk to you about. But no, we don't have a specific database for veterans that leave, that are staying in Michigan, and part of that is because it's really difficult. So if a veteran is coming back off of active duty, they may come home for a few months back to Michigan, and then they may relocate somewhere else. They may not know where they're going. They may not come back to Michigan. Right. So one of the reasons that our agency was created back in 2013 was because when Governor Snyder took over, he had a meeting and he wanted to talk to every agency that did something for veterans, every state agency that touched veterans. So there were 14 people in the room from different agencies, and many of them didn't even know each other, and many of them didn't know that they did something for veterans, and that's why we were created, and just to deal with stuff like that. So I'm sorry that's not a better answer, but like I said, I'm happy to work with you and talk to you. I'm happy to go talk to Treasury and find out what's going on.
I need to talk to this gentleman afterwards because we need to move on, but thank you. So we got time for one more. We promised to get you out of here at 8 o'clock, and we're going to be just a little bit over. Can you guys stay if people have... So these gentlemen will be here. If you had a question for one of them and you didn't get an opportunity to answer it, I'll stay for a little while as well. So if you want to ask me anything or complain about the bias on our programming or what we did or didn't cover, I get that all the time. So I'm happy to hear you talk about that as well. So yes, this lady right here will be our final question for this evening.
Hi, my name is Brittany. As for the gentleman who talked about the suicide prevention, I am a member of the Battle in Distress and Warrior Point. We do respond to veterans who are in an emotional or a physical state of distress. So if we are near the area or they need help, we call them or we go to them physically and we give them any kind of support that they need. The main question I do have is, you were saying that women are marginalized for their service. What can we expect from coming from a man's world into a society to where we are given the help that we need instead of just being labelized as just another service member? Because I do know that there are many women veterans who do want outreach programs, but they don't know where to look for
So there's a little bit of confusion of what the question, the direct question is.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
What
too many ales.
Yeah, that's fine. What can women look for in a program that can help them reach out to prevent any kind of problems that come with them, whether it be emotional, physical, or mentally?
So women veterans?
Yes.
Okay.
The VA, I know the VA in Ann Arbor has a very robust women veteran outreach program. However, they have a problem with attendance. And so I hate to say that, but that's one of their problems, is they can't get enough women veterans into their programs. So each VA across the country, but in the state of Michigan, every VA has a women's outreach program. But the common theme I hear is that they don't have enough women to populate group therapy sessions or group outing sessions and things like that. And so I would encourage women veterans, if they're looking for something, to contact the VA, to contact us. We can contact the VA for you, with you, and coordinate a group of women veterans, because that's what I'm hearing from the VA, is that there's just not enough. I think they have the Ann Arbor VA has a women's veteran group therapy session. They only do it once a month, and it's like Tuesday from 11 to noon or something, the first Tuesday of the month. And the reason that it's not more accessible, like in the evenings or on weekends, is because they don't have enough. And so that's what I would say, is I would encourage women veterans to contact me, contact the VA, let them know where these veterans are and how they can reach them.
So I'd have to agree with that completely. I was at a VA town hall up in U of M Flint a couple weeks ago, and it was one of the big questions they had was how do we get to these female veterans and support them in any way possible? And I think there is a huge disconnect both with the female veteran population and then the people that are trying to provide services and support to them. I don't know what the answer is. I'm not even going to pretend to say that I do know. I wish I did, so we could just fix the problem. But I will say the program I work for is trying to do some things with female veterans in Michigan and try to get some groups together. I know one of the bigger issues is attendance and engagement. But that's not to say that we should just say, oh, well, they're not showing up, but we should just stop. We need to keep trying different ways, different approaches to outreach and recruitment. And I think that the two ends of this, to really come together and make something happen, we just need to keep trying and working to make something happen. Because there's, in some ways, and I'm not even going to pretend to say like I will ever understand what it means to be a female veteran, but it's just some of the problems they experience are the ones we don't even fathom. When I don't go to the VA and get asked if I'm a spouse, you know, the assumption is that I'm a veteran. And so there's just all these things, institutional or otherwise, that need to be addressed. And I think there's an effort being made on both ends of the table, but it's just we need to keep trying and come together as best we can.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us this evening for this discussion. And please join me in thanking these three guys, especially Tim, who didn't know that he was going to do it, but stepped in at the last minute. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.